I'm very, very happy to be taking part in this conference. And what I want to do is to touch on three topics. The first is the economy itself. What's happening to it? Where is it going? Is it recovering? Secondly, I want to talk a bit about economics and where it's gone wrong and where it should be going. And thirdly, more pertinent to the main theme of the conference, the role of the universities in preparing students for future life. And the topics are partly disparate, but I hope that by the end, a common thread will be visible. First, let me say something about the economy. I know this was a subject yesterday, but I want to say something about it again because I've spent much of the last 3 years thinking about it, writing about it, and making speeches about it. So it's very much in the forefront of my mind. I think it's beyond doubt that Osbornism, as I call it, is a busted flush, both as a strategy for recovery and as a strategy of deficit reduction. Even the IMF, and I know Dr. Shafik is going to talk after me, is saying so. And for the IMF to criticize the fiscal policy of a member of the G7 is pretty unprecedented. Not entirely, but pretty much so. Under George Osborne's three-year stewardship of the British economy, it hasn't grown, and the projected deficit is bigger than when he started. One can splay around a whole lot of statistics to make these points. GDP, for example, has UK GDP has grown by a cumulative 1.1% between third quarter 2010 and first quarter 2013. That is hardly at all. In fact, recovery halted when George Osborne took office. GDP today is 2% below its pre-recession peak. And more importantly, GDP per capita, per head, is 6% below its pre-recession peak. With sensible policies, the economy could have been tens of billions of pounds bigger and more productive than it now is. And everyone has been suffering from that, and not least the universities. We have sacrificed a generation on the altar of austerity. In 2010, the budget deficit between 2011 and 2015-16 was forecast to be £322 billion. In June 2013, the forecast was £539 billion. So the deficit reduction policy has not actually reduced the deficit. How did Osborne's policies go so wrong? Well, I think here we have to distinguish a bit between broader ideology and more particular economic doctrine. I mean, pride of place ideologically must go to the conservative hatred of the big state, which conservatives identify with socialism. I think I'm being purely factual here. I'm not making party political point, certainly. Deficit reduction was seen as a means to government reduction. But there was a specific economic doctrine supporting this anti-state ideology, and this was that public spending crowds out an equivalent amount of more efficient private spending. Applied to spending financed by borrowing, anti-statist economics takes the form of something known as Ricardian equivalence. And the chief elements of this are borrowing is deferred taxation, and borrowing raises interest rates. Both propositions amount to saying that public borrowing cannot raise aggregate demand. But in addition, large deficits are said to damage confidence through fear of debt default. So they not only crowd out an equivalent amount of private spending, but reduce it to below what it would have been without the presence of the deficits. From this perspective, rapid deficit reduction is the only way to restore economic growth. Expansionary fiscal policy was the game in town, since quantitative easing was not used in the first 2 years of Osborne's chancellorship. And it was only brought back last autumn when the deficit reduction policy had failed to produce the expected growth. Now, I've simplified, of course. Lots of things were wrong with the British economy before the recession. There was an overextended, overpowerful, unregulated banking system, a bloated public sector, an attenuated manufacturing sector, lagging skills, growing inequality of wealth and incomes. All these things which, you know, feature in supply side sort of discussion needed to be addressed. But on the central macroeconomic question, is a deficit reduction policy the right recipe for recovery following a major shock? Osborne was just plain wrong. The IMF has almost said so, but pulled its punches at the last moment. Now, those who know their economic history will realize that the arguments of the Osborne Treasury are a straight replay of the Treasury view of the late 1920s, which Keynes so effectively challenged in the 1930s. So that brings me to my second topic, what's wrong with economics? Why did the economics profession react so passively to the Osborne recipe for success? The answer is that by the 1980s and the 1990s, mainstream economics had bought into a revamped version of the old neoclassical economics and had come to regard Keynes as little more than a clever idiot. According to the extreme version of the rational expectations theory, extreme version, economies are always at full employment and always growing to trend. This left little or no role for macro stabilization. And in defiance of experience, this nonsense was taught to generations of students with precious few qualifications. And no wonder the generation thus taught were left so unready for the crash of 2008 and for the world after the crash. However, the point I want to make is somewhat different, and that is the virtual absence of British academic economists from the debate, public debate, on the causes of the collapse and the consequences for public policy, which the collapse opened up. These questions go to the heart of economics. Why did the banking system implode? Was there a Minsky moment? Or was rampant moral hazard the main problem? Which schools of economics offer the best guidance to what has happened and been happening, the Keynesian school or the Austrian school? Is there an output gap? How is it to be calculated? How big is the multiplier? How robust is the notion of a structural deficit? What are the transmission mechanisms of quantitative easing, that is, unorthodox monetary policy, supposed to be? British academics could have made a huge contribution to this policy discussion, refining it, raising its level, progressing it. But what happened was almost complete silence. I did a small calculation. In the last 12 months, the Financial Times, which has been the main arena for public discussion of public policy, published about 1,000 op-ed articles on the state of the British economy. Just 16 were by UK academic economists, of which 3 were by me. Two of them together with my colleague Marcus Miller. So Warwick University made a disproportionate contribution to a rather miserable total. I'm a Keynesian, And I've always nailed those colours to the mast ever since the crisis started. But what irked me about the situation was the unwillingness of university economists, whether Keynesian or anti-Keynesian or neither, to come out of their academic closets and engage in the public discussion, which was left almost entirely to journalists, bankers, think tankers, and international organizations. This in face of the worst economic catastrophe for 80 years. Where were the economists? Scribbling away in learned journals which no one reads? You know, I mean, it was a real disgrace. And this public silence, coupled with the students' need to master superfluous mathematical models, suggests that most economic students will leave their studies lamentably ill-equipped to make sense of huge slices of real-world economies. And I'd find it difficult to find such a disconnect between theory and reality in any other scientific or professional training. So, having got that off my chest, I come to my last and third topic. What are universities trying to educate their students for? Now, there's a standard view about this, and I'm sure it's been heard at this forum, and that is that the universities will be the most important growth engine of the future. Through their fundamental research, they will create the new economies, and through their investment in human capital, they will train students for the new jobs. Indeed, it is claimed that investment in human capital will increasingly replace investment in physical capital, which was the historic engine of growth. The story goes something like this. The workplace is being radically transformed by the knowledge economy, the information society, and globalization. To participate fully in the global knowledge economy, Britain's workforce will need to have a set of core competences geared to success in global competition: communication skills, capacity for critical thinking and problem solving, effective and creative IT skills, social skills, language and cultural skills, ethical skills. There are a whole lot of these things. Every list is a bit different, but basically they're all the same. And the task of education, therefore, is to equip them with these skills, the universities being the top tier of a seamless web of training, starting virtually in infancy and culminating in university and post-university. Universities themselves will compete nationally and worldwide to attract the research funding and students to carry out their economic mission. So universities are in the marketplace, just like any other investment vehicles. I wonder, though, whether this is to conceive of their role properly. So I'll be a bit of a skeptic here. No educator at any level can be against developing the human potential of his students. After all, that's what education means, educare, to lead out. But should that potential be seen in such narrowly utilitarian terms? The notion of education as an investment in human capital ties it inextricably to economic growth. Its object is to produce marketable skills, skills that can be turned into money GDP. But I think we have to pause to consider what sort of jobs people will be doing in the future and how much of their lives will be spent doing them, which is a very important consideration as people live longer and longer. The fundamental fact is that automation is destroying jobs at an unprecedented rate. Very soon, we will have driverless cars, probably a little later, pilotless aircraft. We don't need any insurance policies because there'll never be any accidents, because in this world. Made by robots at automated factories. Now, of course, you might say, ever since the Industrial Revolution, economies have been creating new jobs to replace those destroyed by technological progress, because human wants seem to be insatiable, and progress itself creates new wants and new jobs. But I do think we need to ask whether, with so many obvious human needs met, particularly in rich countries, the replacement rate will continue as before, or whether it won't slow down, whether jobless growth will not be increasingly the norm. One can imagine a path of progress in which advances in drugs, diet, and replacement surgery will enable most people to live into their hundreds, creating a whole lot of new doctoring, nursing, caring, mentoring, coaching, advising, and teaching jobs. Well, 200 years ago, Goethe presently imagined the world as a big hospital in which half the people spent their time looking after the other half. Science and progress are bringing this closer. But would that be a happy culmination to thousands of years of civilization and achievement? I wonder. And yet this is quite openly discussed as one of the main sources of the new jobs in our civilization, caring jobs. I'm very much in favor of caring, but I mean it's given a huge prominence in our view of how the future job market will develop. Let's take, though, an opposite premise, that over the next 50 years, the job market will inexorably shrink as the satisfaction of human needs becomes increasingly automated. That's to say, people will live longer and longer, but need to work fewer and fewer hours. The social and economic readjustments such a society will need, if it is not to explode in unremitting peasant revolts against worklessness, dwarf all those currently fashionable concerns with skilling. That seems to be what people now talk about more than anything else. Yes, of course, automation is destroying jobs. What we have to do is keep ahead of the curve in our skilling, reskilling, and retooling processes of human capital so that we can live and flourish in the global economy. That, I've heard dozens of people say exactly that. But I think we have to ask a question. In my view, education will be as much for leisure as for work. We will not be able to afford to take a laissez-faire attitude to the distribution of wealth and income, which we are now doing. A small minority, it could be argued, will create most of the wealth, but they will have to surrender most of it to those who create no wealth. Something that's outside the box at the moment. Population questions to do with both quality and quantity will come back seriously into the reckoning. And all of this suggests to me an alternative role for the universities as nurseries of leisure. Their task will be to equip their students with skills in living and not just earning a living. Learning will be more important than ever, but it will be once again learning for its own sake and not to acquire marketable skills. And it will have to be lifelong learning as people live longer and longer. When people talk about the need to rebalance the economy, these are some of the directions which I think their thoughts should take, because the recovery from the present recession, when it comes, will be a relatively jobless recovery. Joblessness and near joblessness will become features of the new normal, and not just of recessions. Youth employment will become endemic. Insensitive to the present and oblivious to the future, economics will need extensive retooling itself if it is to retain its relevance. It was born in the age of scarcity and will need to come to terms with the age of plenty. I don't quite see how this can be done. I think its axioms are so deeply laid in the world of Adam Smith and the analogy with physics that I don't actually see how it can reconstruct itself. And it may be that over the long period of time, a lot of economics, not all of it, a lot of economics will be seen as a failed discipline, one of those failed intellectual projects of which history is so full, have had a very, very good run for its money. But in the end, economists didn't become as useful as dentists. What I do see is that macroeconomics, the study of the behavior of the economy as a whole, needs to be detached from microeconomics, the study of the behavior of individuals and firms. Macroeconomics is part of the art of government. It belongs with political philosophy, legal philosophy, and politics, and should never be detached from them. So I think economics proper should be, as it always really was, microeconomics. And then there's something else, which Keynes sort of bolted on, called macroeconomics, which doesn't really fit. And microeconomics is very useful for all kinds of purposes, but macroeconomics, I think, is part of a different order of thinking and a different realm of policy. So I conclude by hoping that and expecting that Warwick University, which has always been a pioneer university, can continue to give a creative lead in all these directions. Thank you very much.